This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Good evening and welcome to the Birch Aquarium at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego. My name is Nigella Hilgarth, and I'm the Executive Director here at the Birch Aquarium. And it's my pleasure to welcome you to the latest in the Jeffrey B. Graham series, the Perspectives on Ocean Science Speaker Series. And it's great, my great pleasure this evening to introduce tonight's speaker, who's Dr. Amy Lang. Amy did her undergraduate degree at Auburn University in Alabama on marine biology. And then she came to San Diego and hasn't left. She went to San Diego State for her master's degree in animal behavior. In fact, it was interdisciplinary between psychology and animal behavior, and she focused on dolphins. So you might say, what could be cooler than that? Well, I think what she then did for her dissertation was extraordinarily cool. She came to Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and she did her dissertation on whales. In fact, it was the population genetics of gray whales in the North Pacific. And Amy is now next door to us at Southwest Fisheries, where she is also working on whales. I'm so jealous. And her current projects include using genetics to evaluate stock structure and recruitment in eastern gray whales, and assessing the global taxonomy of blue whales utilizing microgenetic and nuclear sequence data. So very exciting research, and I can't wait to hear what Amy's going to talk to us tonight on gray whales in the North Pacific, insight into behavior using genetics. So please join me in welcoming Amy.
So first, I just want to say thank you for giving me the opportunity to be up here tonight and to share some of our recent work using genetics to better understand the behavior of gray whales in the North Pacific. And some of the work I'm going to talk about tonight is from my dissertation, which was, as Nigella mentioned, down at Scripps. And some of the results are derived from my postdoc work at the Southwest Fisheries Science Center. I want to start by saying that gray whales are one of the most well-studied of the baleen whales, in large part because they spend much of their time in coastal waters. Gray whales also have a long history with Scripps. The first shore-based counts of gray whales migrating past San Diego were conducted by Carl Hubbs and Ray Gilmore from the rooftop of Ritter Hall in the 1940s. And you can see here that Scripps hosted a workshop on the California gray whale, as it was then called, in 1972, and that was chaired by Carl Hubbs as well. Now, the National Marine Fisheries Service has been monitoring the eastern North Pacific gray whale population's abundance for over 40 years now. And this year marks the 20th anniversary of the National Marine Fisheries Service monitoring of calf production in that population. So we have really a wealth of data on gray whales on our hands here. Despite these many years of study, however, our understanding of gray whales has changed markedly over the past 3 years. And it's really been an exciting time to be a scientist studying these animals. Although many of you are probably aware of the recent developments in our understanding of gray whale behavior, for this talk I'm going to start with what I would call our traditional understanding of gray whale distribution and behavior, and then I'm going to go into how that understanding has changed over time, both as part of the genetic work as well as through a wide range of other studies. Although gray whales were historically found in the North Atlantic Ocean, that population went extinct in the mid-1700s, and gray whales are currently found only in the North Pacific. Within that region, there are two stocks recognized by the National Marine Fisheries Service, an Eastern North Pacific stock and a Western North Pacific stock. And both of these stocks were greatly depleted by commercial whaling. Now, commercial whaling in the Eastern North Pacific stock ceased due to an international ban in the 1940s, and that stock showed an increase in numbers over recent years and currently numbers approximately 19,000 animals. And Eastern North Pacific gray whales were removed from the list of endangered species in 1994. Now, the majority of those 19,000 Eastern North Pacific gray whales feed up in the Bering, Beaufort, and Chukchi Seas during summer and fall, and then migrate down the coast of North America to overwinter in the lagoons and coastal waters of Baja, Mexico. However, a small number of gray whales do feed in more southern waters located between Northern California and southeastern Alaska. And I'm going to refer to this area as the southern feeding ground for gray whales, as opposed to the northern feeding ground up north of the Aleutians. Now, although early work with photo identification had shown that at least some individual whales returned to this southern feeding ground year after year, interest in this group of animals really didn't heighten until the mid-1990s. And that increased interest was due to the fact that, following the delisting of the Eastern North Pacific stock of gray whales, the Macaw tribe of Northwest Washington expressed an interest in resuming their subsistence harvest of gray whales. The Macaw usual and accustomed hunting grounds are located within this southern feeding ground. And the proposed hunt by the Macaw includes restrictions to limit the chance of taking a whale showing fidelity to this southern feeding ground. However, it is impossible to ensure that none of these whales would be taken, and this has highlighted the need to evaluate the potential impact of that proposed hunt. And photo identification and genetic studies of these southern feeding ground whales were initiated in the mid to late 1990s in response to this need. Now, from these photo identification studies, we know that whales using this southern feeding ground are made up of two groups. The first group includes individuals which are sighted only during one feeding season, and they're thought to be stragglers from the migration. So these are whales that are sighted maybe once, maybe a couple of times on the southern feeding ground, and we think they're just whales stopping in for a bite to eat on their way further north. The second group includes individuals which show intra and interseasonal sight fidelity to the feeding ground. So these are whales that are sighted multiple times within a feeding season, and they return for multiple feeding seasons. Now, we've come to call this group of whales the Pacific Coast Feeding Group, or PCFG, and this group is comprised of about 200 individuals, and that includes some animals which were first identified on this feeding ground as calves and then returned in later years as juveniles or adults. Now, genetic studies conducted in the mid to late 1990s did not support the Pacific Coast Feeding Group being a separate stock. And the PCFG is currently considered part of that larger group of Eastern North Pacific gray whales that feeds further north. Now, the situation in the Western North Pacific is quite different. Commercial whaling for Western North Pacific gray whales continued through at least 1966, and that's because some of the countries that border the range of the Western gray whale didn't sign on to that international ban until much later. And little was known about the current status of Western North Pacific gray whales until 1995. In 1995, a joint Russia-U.S. research program was initiated to study those Western North Pacific gray whales off of Sakhalin Island, Russia, which is located here. And this is considered the primary feeding ground for that group of gray whales. Now, based on these photo identification studies, which started in 1995 but have continued to the present time, we know that the number of gray whales using that feeding ground is small. It's currently estimated to be about 130 animals. We know that individuals show high levels of seasonal sight fidelity and annual return to that area. So there are many whales in that area that we see year after year after year. And that includes some animals, again, that were first identified as calves, so they were brought to that area by their mothers, and then they returned in subsequent years as juveniles or adults. We also know that there are a few new animals identified each year, and that suggests that we've identified most of the animals in that population. And that there is a low number of known reproductive females, a slow rate of population increase, and low calf survival. And in combination with the small population size, these last three factors were important in getting Western North Pacific gray whales listed as critically endangered by the IUCN in 2000. There are numerous potential threats that face these gray whales, Western North Pacific gray whales, but two of the primary threats of concern are entanglement in fishing gear and disturbance from offshore oil and gas activities. So between 2005 and 2007, there were 4 female gray whales that were entrapped and killed in set nets off of Japan. As well, we know that there's a rapidly expanding oil and gas industry off Sakhalin that may be causing disturbance to these whales on their feeding ground. Now, we know very little about the distribution of gray whales in the western North Pacific outside of that Sakhalin feeding ground. There have been only 14 records of gray whales off Japan since 1990. Most of those records are concentrated between March and May, when animals would have been migrating past this area. We do have one record of an animal that is linked to Sakhalin. This was an animal first identified as a calf with its mother on that primary feeding ground and was later entrapped in a net off of Japan. And then we have 2 records of gray whales off China since 1996. And the most recent of these was a gray whale off the coast of China in November of 2011. Now, despite these records, we still don't know where the location of the wintering grounds for these animals is located, but we suspect it's located in the vicinity of the South China Sea, down in this area. So that was kind of the state of understanding when I first started my PhD at Scripps many, many years ago. And the primary objective of that work was to evaluate genetic differences between gray whales in the eastern and western North Pacific. Now, to do that, we used 2 different kinds of genetic markers. The first marker I'm going to talk about is called mitochondrial DNA. This is DNA that is maternally inherited, so you only get your mitochondrial DNA from your mother. You don't receive anything mitochondrial DNA from your father. And we refer to these sequences as haplotypes, so that's going to be how I'm going to refer to them further in the talk. And you can kind of think of this as in inheriting a family name. But instead of inheriting your dad's last name, you're inheriting your mother's last name in this case. Now, these markers have shown to be really valuable in tracking behaviors that are passed down from a mother to her calf. So I've mentioned a few times now that we do have observations of gray whale mothers bringing their calves to a feeding ground, and then those calves returning in later years. And we would guess that if those calves are females, they would later return with their own offspring in the future. And you can imagine, we're going to refer to this behavior as matrilineal fidelity. And you can imagine if a mother is bringing many of her calves to this feeding ground year after year, and those calves are eventually bringing their own calves to the feeding ground, and all of them share the same mitochondrial DNA haplotype, that's going to result in differences in mitochondrial DNA building up across these feeding grounds. The second type of marker I'm going to talk about today is microsatellites. Now, these are biparentally inherited nuclear markers. That means you get one copy from your mother and one from your father, and then they get all mixed up in your DNA. So we use nuclear DNA to look at patterns of interbreeding. And by that I mean we can use this type of marker to track whether animals in one group are breeding with animals in another group, or if they're primarily just breeding within their own group. So if we do have random mating between 2 different groups of animals, we won't see nuclear differences. But if we have animals that are primarily breeding with other animals in their own group, we would expect to see differences in this nuclear DNA. Now, microsatellites also have another cool feature. They can be used to create essentially a genetic fingerprint for each individual. So if we use multiple of these microsatellite loci, they can create a unique genetic profile for each individual. And we can use that genetic profile for a couple of different things. First, it allows us to detect samples that are collected from the same individual. So if we have a sample collected from a whale in one area, and we obtain its genetic profile, and then we collect a sample from another whale in another area, and it has the same genetic profile, then we can infer that the animal has moved between those 2 areas. We can also use these types of markers to look at relatedness between individuals. So now we've talked about the type of genetic markers we're going to use to study gray whales and what they can say about the movements and behavior of individuals. The next thing on the list is to determine what samples we're going to use to address these questions. And for my dissertation work, we were able to collect 142 samples from individuals off of Sakhalin. These samples do represent 83% of all the animals we've identified in that area through 2007. So this is a really unique data set. And unfortunately, it's so unique because this is just such a small group of animals. They come back here every year, so we were able to collect all these samples. It's virtually impossible to do with a larger group of whales. Now, all of these samples were collected via biopsy darting of free-ranging whales. So this process involves using a crossbow to shoot a modified dart tip into the side of the whale And this tip collects a very tiny bit of tissue. You can see here, it's usually mostly skin, but can contain a small amount of blubber from the whale. And usually the amount of tissue that are collected by these darts is about the size of a pencil eraser. Although some whales do react to this type of sampling, the reactions are generally mild and short-lived, and no long-lasting impacts to the whales have been documented. We were also able to collect samples from 136 individuals to represent the eastern North Pacific gray whales. The majority of these samples were obtained from gray whales that stranded along the migratory route. So there's a wide range of stranding centers along California, Oregon, Washington, that all send, when they get a stranded whale, they'll collect a sample of its tissue and send it back to our lab, and we can use it for our studies. Some of the samples from the eastern North Pacific were from biopsied animals, and some were collected from animals that were taken in the Russian Aboriginal harvest. So there is an ongoing harvest of gray whales on the Chukotka Peninsula up in Russia, and we were able to get some samples from those harvested whales. So what did we learn? Well, when we compared the genetics of Sakhalin whales with those in the eastern North Pacific, we found differences in the mitochondrial DNA haplotype frequencies between those groups. We also found reduced mitochondrial DNA diversity in those Sakhalin whales. These results support strong matrilineal fidelity to the area. So again, you can imagine as mitochondrial DNA is passed down from a mother to her offspring, then the frequencies of those haplotypes carried by the mother and her offspring will build up over time. This will create a difference between feeding areas or between areas generally. And a high frequency of a few haplotypes results in a reduction in mitochondrial DNA diversity. And this is what we see in the whales off Sakhalin. We see two haplotypes that are found in very high frequencies, and these are haplotypes that most of our reproductive females carry. We also see a few moderate frequency haplotypes, and then several haplotypes that are found in only one or two individuals. And those individuals are in most cases males. Comparison of Sakhalin with Eastern North Pacific gray whales using nuclear DNA also revealed differences. This suggests that there is some degree of reproductive isolation between Sakhalin and animals that are part of the Eastern North Pacific stock. Now, we also wanted to get a more detailed picture of which of the animals in that Sakhalin group were interbreeding with each other. So to do this, we used a paternity analysis of the Sakhalin calves based on that microsatellite data. So again, we have 83% of the animals off Sakhalin sampled, and that sample set includes 57 cow-calf pairs, which represents 90% of all identified cow-calf pairs in that area. We also had samples from 55 males. This included animals that were of unknown age, so they were identified as adults, as well as some animals that were first identified as calves, and we knew to be at least 5 years old during the study. So we were able to assign 46% of those calves to males sampled off Sakhalin. So we were able to assign fathers for about half of our calves. Now, this is similar to results we see in other cetacean studies. They typically have a pretty low success rate. But we were surprised given the high proportion of animals that we have sampled off Sakhalin. So, for example, you would imagine if you have approximately 80% of your individuals sampled, and those individuals, that sample represents a random representation of the group, you would expect to be able to assign somewhere along the lines of about 80% of those paternities. Now, that study identified 17 males as possible fathers of at least one calf, and most of those fathers were assigned paternity of only one calf during the study. But you can see there were a few males that were more successful and were assigned paternities of 2 to 3 calves during the 12 years of the study. Now, of those 17 assigned fathers, most are animals that demonstrate high levels of site fidelity to the Sakhalin feeding ground. So the majority of those whales were sighted for at least 8 of the 12 seasons that were incorporated into this study. As well, in the majority of cases, the assigned father was sighted on the Sakhalin feeding ground in the season prior to the calf's birth. We were not able to assign paternity to any animals of known age, so we weren't able to provide any information about the age at which males first reproduce. Now, perhaps more interesting were the 31 calves that we were not able to assign to a possible father. And we were able to use the relatedness patterns of those calves to get an idea of how many males we were kind of missing in our analysis. And that suggested we were missing about 17 fathers. So that's about half of the males that are contributing to reproduction in this group. So if we have 17 males assigned as fathers and approximately 17 males that we think could account for those unassigned calves, that suggests there are about 34 males contributing to reproduction in this group of animals. And during that part of the study, we had 23 known reproductive females. And taken together, this suggests there's only a small number of animals contributing to reproduction in this group. So this raised questions about where those missing fathers could be. And we have a couple ideas about that. So the first is that they could be animals that use the Sakhalin feeding ground, but which we have not been able to sample. So we know that we have 18 animals of unknown age and sex, which were photographed off Sakhalin, but we were never able to get close enough to sample. Now, you would be surprised to think that to find that all 18 of those were males. We would expect about half of them to be females. But it's possible that some behavioral bias exists, such that these reproductive males are essentially better at evading sampling, and so they represent a higher proportion of that group. Another possibility is that there are additional feeding areas in the western North Pacific where these whales go during summer. Now, recently, we've realized that some of the whales that feed off Sakhalin also feed off of southeastern Kamchatka, located here. However, not all the whales that feed off southeastern Kamchatka are known from Sakhalin. So it's possible some of those whales feeding in that area are our missing fathers. The final possibility is that those missing fathers are part of the eastern North Pacific stock. So this would suggest that there could be some level of interbreeding within the western and eastern North Pacific. Now, we did run the paternity analysis with the eastern males included, and we were not able to identify any additional paternities. But given that we have such a very small percentage of those 19,000 animals sampled, this result is not very meaningful. It does suggest, however, that given the small size of the western population, it seems unlikely that a significant amount of gene flow with eastern whales could occur without eroding that genetic signal of nuclear differences that we saw in our microsatellite data. Now, as part of the analyses from our PhD, we also found something that we weren't really looking for. So it's pretty standard in genetic analyses to compare the genetic profiles of all your sampled individuals to detect any duplicate samples, so to find any samples that might have been collected from the same animal and remove one of those because you don't want to bias your analyses. And when we ran that analysis, we identified two animals that were biopsied in the Santa Barbara Channel in spring that were genetically identical to two animals biopsied off Sakhalin during the summer. Now, this was really exciting information, but I have to admit we really couldn't quite wrap our heads around it. In the end, I included this information as a chapter in my dissertation, along with some discussion of whether this could be a random event, like a lab mix-up or two animals matching by chance, or if it could imply that there's some dispersal of animals from Sakhalin to the eastern North Pacific. That discussion assumed that any such dispersal events must be very rare, given all we knew about the Sakhalin animals, as well as the large distance any animal would have to travel to make that type of journey. I completed my dissertation in June of 2010. On October 4th of 2010, Bruce Mate and his colleagues tagged Flex, a 13-year-old male gray whale off the coast of Sakhalin Island. And Flex was well known to those of us who studied off Sakhalin, and we had actually identified him as a calf many years earlier. Now, everyone, I think, was surprised when they saw Flex not go south toward the South China Sea as we were anticipating, but instead take quite a journey across the Bering Sea and traveling all the way to the Pacific Northwest before his tag stopped transmitting. And in fact, Bruce was able to successfully tag two additional gray whales off Sakhalin in the 2011 season, and both of those animals also headed east across the North Pacific. So as a result of those findings and those tagged animals, a large-scale Pacific-wide comparison of gray whales photographed in both the eastern and the western North Pacific was initiated in collaboration with scientists from Russia, from Mexico, and from the U.S. So in addition to the results from the tagging and the genetic analyses, and I've marked those genetic matches here, we also identified six whales that were photographed off the coast of Vancouver Island and had also been photographed off Sakhalin. Interestingly, one of those whales happened to be Flex. And we photographed 14 whales were photographed down in the lagoons off of Mexico that were also matched to the Sakhalin feeding ground. So taken together, that suggests at least 22 of those approximately 130 whales that feed off Sakhalin have moved into the eastern North Pacific at least once during their lifetime. So in combination, these results suggest that, or show that, some gray whales that feed off Sakhalin do overwinter in the eastern North Pacific. And this was truly quite a surprise for those of us studying gray whales for a long time. So the converse of that is that not all the animals which feed off Sakhalin remain in the western North Pacific year-round. But if you remember in my earlier introduction, we do know that some whales remain in the western North Pacific during winter and spring. We have those 13 records of gray whales off Japan since 1990, including one known match to Sakhalin, and two gray whales recorded off China since 1996. So when you really think about it, these results raise concern that the number of gray whales remaining in the western North Pacific year-round may be smaller than we had previously estimated. So essentially, all this time, we've been assuming that there were 130 western North Pacific gray whales, and we were pretty concerned about the fact that there were only 130. But these results suggest that actually the number of what you might call true western gray whales that stay in the western North Pacific year-round could be quite a bit smaller. Now, this movement data also highlighted the need to re-examine or re-evaluate the results of our genetic comparisons. So if you remember, the comparison of nuclear DNA indicated that some degree of reproductive isolation occurs between the western and eastern North Pacific, and the results of our paternity analysis supported interbreeding of some of the animals off of Sakhalin. However, we did have those approximately 50% of fathers that were essentially missing from our Sakhalin sample set. So this raises the question of where gray whales breed, and in fact, we don't have a lot of information on that. The information we do have comes from whales that were taken off the by scientific permit off the coast of Central California in the 50s and 60s. And analysis of data from those whales by Rice and Woolman suggested that the first round of breeding in gray whales occurs in late November to early December. And they hypothesized that for those whales that don't successfully breed during that time period, a second round of breeding may occur later when the whales are closer to the lagoons. So that gave us kind of a time frame to think about, but where are the whales during that first breeding period? Well, we know something about the migration of gray whales in the eastern North Pacific based on counts of whales at different points along the migratory route. And that information suggests that the median passage date through Unimak Pass is about the 12th of December. So kind of in that first breeding period, you might expect that some proportion of the animals in the eastern North Pacific population are still going to be up somewhere in this area. Now, we know even less about the migratory timing in the western North Pacific. It's possible that that nuclear signal that we're seeing comes from the animals that do stay in the western North Pacific year-round and migrate down the coast and breed somewhere in that area. But it's also possible that those whales that travel from Sakhalin to the eastern North Pacific are pretty far west during that first round of mating. So it is possible that that could be generating the nuclear signal that we're seeing in our data. The differences in both the nuclear DNA and the mitochondrial DNA between the animals sampled off Sakhalin and those in the eastern North Pacific support the continued recognition of the Sakhalin animals as a distinct group. So while all that was going on in the western North Pacific, there was also some new information coming out of the eastern North Pacific. So as I mentioned earlier, original genetic studies of the Pacific Coast feeding group animals, those animals that feed in that southern feeding ground, did not support their recognition as being separate from the larger eastern North Pacific. But in 2010, some preliminary results were released from a study by Tim Fraser and Jim Darling that did find differences in mitochondrial DNA between the Pacific Coast feeding group whales and samples largely collected from whales on the eastern North Pacific migratory route. And they concluded that their data showed that the southern feeding group of gray whales does qualify as a separate management unit. Now, this study raised a red flag that we needed to do some more genetic work to look at this Pacific Coast feeding group of gray whales. Now, to do that, we needed more genetic samples. In particular, we wanted to be able to compare animals on that southern feeding ground representing the PCFG with animals sampled on the other primary feeding ground for eastern North Pacific gray whales located north of the Aleutians. And this is an area where it's actually quite difficult to get samples. So the majority of our samples did come from gray whales that were taken in that harvest off Chukotka, the Russian Aboriginal harvest. But there were a handful of samples that collected from biopsied animals off of Barrow, as well as along the Koryak coast here. Now, we were also able to obtain samples from 71 PCFG individuals. All of these samples were collected in tandem with a photograph, and that photograph allowed us to basically tie in that sample to the sighting history of a whale. So this allowed us to restrict our sample set to only those animals identified in 2 or more years on that southern feeding ground. And we needed to do this to eliminate the chance of including one of those whales that's just kind of moving through the area and grabbing a snack before it heads further north. So the primary question we were interested in here is whether animals move between these feeding areas in the eastern North Pacific, or whether most animals are learning to feed from their mothers and exhibiting that pattern of matrilineal fidelity. Now, as I mentioned, the photo identification studies have shown that matrilineal fidelity does occur on that southern feeding ground. But there are some limitations to using photo identification data to document that pattern. For one thing, those findings are restricted to the period under which the animals were studied. So systematic studies of that southern feeding ground didn't begin until 1998, so we weren't able to say anything about what was occurring in that group prior to that time. Whereas genetics allows us to kind of look back in time and determine if this pattern of matrilineal fidelity has been occurring for long enough that genetic differences between groups can build. Now, a second limitation of the photo identification, using photo identification data to look at this matrilineal fidelity pattern, is related to their survey effort. And I should say here that they actually document relatively few calves on the southern feeding ground. And that may be a real finding. It may be that very few mothers bring their calves to this area. But it also could be an artifact of the survey effort. So just due to poor weather conditions earlier in the season, most of the survey effort in that area occurs during late summer and fall. And you can imagine during that time period, many calves may have already separated from their mothers. And a calf that's, you know, 7, 8 months old, separated from its mother, is actually pretty hard to distinguish from a juvenile or a young adult. So it's possible that there were more calves there and a greater signal of this matrilineal fidelity, but that it was missed because the survey effort is mostly conducted in late summer and fall. Now, the second question we were interested in is whether the Pacific Coast feeding group animals interbreed with animals that feed further north. And it has always been assumed that the Pacific Coast feeding group animals do interbreed with the rest of the eastern North Pacific population, but this had never been tested explicitly, as all the earlier genetic studies had only used the mitochondrial DNA marker, which only relates to maternal patterns of inheritance. So comparison of the Pacific Coast feeding group samples with whales from the northern feeding grounds revealed no detectable nuclear differences. So this indicates that whales from those different feeding grounds used by the eastern North Pacific gray whales likely interbreed. So that wasn't a big surprise to most people. Now, when we looked at the mitochondrial DNA, we did find differences in the mitochondrial DNA haplotype frequencies between the PCFG and the northern feeding ground animals. And this does indicate that utilization of feeding areas is influenced by matrilineal fidelity. However, the results from the Pacific Coast feeding group whales didn't fit that neatly into what we expected from a small population that has very little interchange with other feeding groups. So, for example, the differences in mitochondrial DNA that we identified, while they were significant, they were quite small. And the level of mitochondrial DNA diversity within the PCFG was quite high. And in fact, it was very similar to the level of diversity we see among those animals sampled on the northern feeding ground. And that's a sample set that's intended to represent approximately 19,000 animals, as opposed to the PCFG, which is considered to be about 200 animals. As well, if we look back at the photo identification data, we can see that new PCFG animals are photographically identified each year, despite the fact that this survey has been ongoing since 1998. So other explanations are possible, but these findings raise the possibility that there could be some immigration of animals from that northern feeding ground into the Pacific Coast feeding group. And this is important to evaluate further in light of that proposed hunt by the macaw. And we are actually currently working on ideas of how to better address this with our genetic data. So in conclusion, it's clear that population structure in gray whales is much more complex than we knew about several years ago. To gain insight into that complexity, we really need to use all the tools that are available to us as scientists. For example, our current understanding of the behavior of gray whales relies on data from genetics, from tagging of animals, and from photo identification studies. And each of these sources has contributed information that is important in helping us to understand what these whales are doing at different times of the year. Although integration of this information has answered many questions, it has also raised others, some of which have important consequences to the future conservation and management of gray whales. Two of the most important questions are how much immigration into that Pacific Coast feeding group is occurring, and what proportion of the whales off Sakhalin migrate to the eastern North Pacific. Now, both of these questions are important in evaluating the potential impact of that proposed hunt by the macaw. In addition, the latter question has important implications when we consider how many gray whales remain in the western North Pacific year-round. Based on the information we have already, we know that at least 22 of those 130 gray whales that feed off Sakhalin may have visited the eastern North Pacific. This suggests that the number of animals remaining in the western North Pacific year-round may be lower, and potentially much lower than we previously estimated, and thus of greater conservation concern. And this really highlights the need to learn more about gray whales in other parts of the western North Pacific, such as off of Japan or China. And with that, I'd just like to thank all the many, many people who contributed to this work. It takes a lot of effort to collect samples for this type of project, and there are a lot of, as well as the photo identification data to go along with it. So I want to just acknowledge those co-authors here. And I'm happy to take any questions. Her question relates to the fact that there was a whale killed by the macaw tribe, legally killed by the macaw tribe in 1999, and whether or not the macaw tribe supplied us with a sample of that whale so we could look at its DNA. And the answer is yes. The macaw tribe did collect a sample from that whale, and they did send it to our lab, and it did not turn out to be a Pacific Coast feeding group whale. And I should mention here that actually a lot of the samples in the project were collected by the macaw tribal biologist who has been working with us to collect these samples to sort of inform their hunt, which has been an interesting experience. The question is whether, in looking at the genetics of the gray whales off of Sakhalin, do we see any signature of recovery in those animals? And actually, the nuclear genetic diversity found in the animals off Sakhalin is fairly high. It's similar to what we see in the other groups of animals. Whether that's a signature of recovery or whether that's related to the possibility that some of these animals are actually from the eastern North Pacific, we can't really address currently. So the question related to how many whales were left at the end of commercial whaling when it stopped around the 1940s and how it relates to the current population size. And there's actually a fair bit of debate about how low the population was depleted. Some reports indicate it got down to a couple of thousand animals. Other reports suggest it was more like 7,000, 8,000, maybe 10,000 animals. So we don't really have a good feel for that. And that kind of has made it difficult in times to understand exactly how the recovery happened or more about the recovery. So the question is how long gray whales live and what the reproductive span is for females. And, gray whales do live for quite a long time, which means we actually don't have as good of data on that because it's about as long as a scientist career span, essentially. But we think it's on the order of like 45 to 50 years, but there have been some reports of whales that might have been as old as 70 or 80. Female gray whales are first reproduced around the age of 7. So I guess if they live to be... They first reproduce at the age of 7, and they can reproduce a calf every 2 years. So that's... If assuming that they reproduce through the end of their life, is that about 20 calves per female? So we can identify them based on fluke pictures like this, as well as pictures of their sides and flanks. But we use basically the same kind of markers. So you can see there's all these patterns of gray and white pigment along the fluke tips. And those pigment patterns are unique to each whale. And they do stay with the whale throughout its lifespan. Now, the gray whales will also get basically barnacle scars, like these more circular scars here. And those are also long-term scars, although we're not sure if they last the entire lifespan or not. But that's how we identify individual whales in the field. So the question is, if I'm interpreting right, is do we know the sex of those animals that are moving between Sakhalin and the eastern North Pacific? And the answer is we have sex information for almost all of them, and it looks to be about even in terms of about half of them are females and about half are males. We actually, I guess, don't really know if it's if there's a possibility that animals, if the animals were originally from the Western North Pacific and are now traveling to the Eastern North Pacific, or if they originated in the Eastern North Pacific and have just now started going west. I would say from the genetics, it's more likely that the animals feeding off Sakhalin are animals that originated in the Eastern North Pacific, travel to Sakhalin, and then return to overwinter each year. The question is whether I actually get to go out on boats, and I'm really glad to say the answer is yes. I was able to spend six summers essentially over on Sakhalin at our field camp there as part of my PhD. It was a really wonderful and amazing experience and unparalleled. I wish I could go back. So the question is if there's any DNA that we've been able to obtain from gray whales in the North Atlantic, so basically from bones of animals that were recovered in that area. And the answer is yes. There are bones of those animals, and there is a study that's currently ongoing to look at the DNA and see how closely related those animals from the North Atlantic were to the North Pacific. But it's not complete yet. So the question is why the group dynamics are important in terms of evaluating the impact of the hunt. And that's a really good question. So basically, you can imagine if that Pacific Coast feeding group of gray whales, if all the whales learn to go to that area from their mothers, and it's a small group of animals, and we start taking some of those females. So some of those females are accidentally killed in the hunt. Basically, they can no longer bring calves to the area, and it's going to really limit the growth potential of that group. And so eventually, the number of animals using that area would decline. Now, if there's a lot of animals, or even just a moderate number of animals from further north that are immigrating into the group year after year, then it's probably not going to matter as much in terms of just the number of animals using that area, whether the macaw take a whale from that area. Does that make sense? The question is whether there are gray whales in the southern hemisphere, and no, they're not. They're actually fairly unique in that way. They're limited to the northern hemisphere. The question is whether the animals that migrate down to the lagoons do that consistently year after year. And that is what we think happens, although we do know that at least a small number of whales occasionally remain up in that northern feeding ground over winter, and we have some evidence that some individuals in that southern feeding group have remained in that area throughout the winter. But in general, we think that they tend to come down most years. The question is whether we have collected tissue samples from the lagoons down in Baja, and I have not personally, but there are samples being collected in that area, and they have been used in some genetic studies in the past.
I'd like to thank you, Amy, for a wonderful talk, and I'm sure she'd be glad to stay here and answer a few extra questions for those of you who may not have gotten yours in, and thank you all for coming.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.